You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Gary Braver, in addition to sharing my first name, is the author of many thrillers, including Tunnel Vision and Flashback. And Tess Gerritsen, in addition to sharing my birthday, has sold 25 million books and has written many thrillers and romances, and is the creator of the characters Rizzoli and Isles, who you may have seen on TV. These two have joined forces to create a new thriller called Choose Me. And it's an honor for me to say, Tess Gerritsen and Gary Braver, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thanks for having us.
So why and how did you two team up?
Gary, do you want to take that?
Sure. Well, we've known each other for 25 years or so, and at a Christmas party a few years back, Tess came up to me and said, would you like to do a book together? And I said, give me a nanosecond to think this over. And it was at the height of the Me Too disgraces, you know, Harvey Weinstein and, you know, Matt Lauer and others. And at that time, Matt Damon had gotten badly criticized because he had said there was a spectrum of, you know, of behaviors that would be classified as, you know, sexual harassment, from a wink to rape. And he was really criticized very heavily by that, because he'd seemed so tone deaf. And Tess and I got together and said, well, maybe we should put together a book that is about an illicit affair and giving both sides.
Yeah. And obviously I got that it was kind of a Me Too influenced thing. And I want to get into the meat of that. But let me ask you first, how do you collaborate on a thriller? Who writes what? Did you know where the other was going? Did you play a game where you did a chapter, then he did a chapter? What?
Well, I think that the number one thing was that he was going to write the male point of view and I was going to write the female point of view, because, you know, in my mind, point of view is story. The story is all about who's seeing what's happening. And in fact, two people can have the same experience and yet both see it in completely different ways and tell different stories. So that was the first idea, was that we would see the same occurrences, but see how each character thinks, views of it differently. As far as the plotting, boy, that was a mess. We weren't quite sure where we were going. We only knew there was a death, and we knew there would be a murder investigation. We knew that the affair would be illicit. But as to who did it, there was a lot of debate between us about who was the bad guy. Was the professor the bad guy, or was there some other party? So a lot of it was sort of feeling our way through a story. Gary would write a chapter. I would write after that. He would write a chapter, and sometimes we'd go off the rails. But we pull it back, and that's the story was told in a kind of a meandering way. But I think it ended up feeling like it was one author almost.
Oh yeah, that's why I'm asking, because it's a very satisfying book, and it was like, well, how could two people write this? But obviously, you did it very skillfully. Tess Gerritsen, were you, because you published so many books, were you working on some other things while you were working on this, or this was your focus for a while?
I was doing a couple things at the time. I mean, in fact, my next book, which I wrote sort of in the middle of this, is going to be coming out in 2022. So that's done. So yeah, but I'm always doing a couple of things. And then I during the pandemic, I also finished a pilot television script. So it was in a terrible time, but on the other hand, it was a very creative time for some of us.
Sure. Yes. There's some good things that come out of it. Like right now, we're looking at each other on Zoom, which is a nice thing, rather than just talking on the phone as I used to do it. Well, Gary, I want to ask you, Gary Braver, you're also in another, with another name, you are a college professor. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I teach college also. I teach film appreciation at Monterey Peninsula College. So I want to know if you had any reservations about, I mean, you've already spoken about I don't want to give away too much of your story because it's a whodunit and a thriller, but you've already spoken about the Me Too aspects of Choose Me. And I want to know if you felt any reservations about having an illicit affair between a teacher and student.
No, you know, when I first started teaching many years ago, professors and students socialized, and sometimes they dated, and it was often looked the other way. And ever since Title IX came down 15 so years ago, and tightened up over the last few years because of the Department of Education, it is absolutely forbidden now for professors to date students or have any sexual relationship or romantic relationship with a student over whom they have supervisory control or authority, you know, grades, you know, hiring. And I was not troubled by writing about that. It had gone on while I was there in earlier years, but it was really, it's really a story about a man who is torn with guilt, and he's, you know, he's got his reasons for seeking intimacy elsewhere. And yet he has, he's got capacity for guilt. And so it really is, even though it is an academic setting, it's really more of a human story too. The academic setting raises the risk beyond just, you know, breaking marriage vows. It raises the risk you can get terminated and be disgraced.
Yeah. And the only reason I ask is because I think, and I used to teach middle school as well for many years. And, you know, I think parents, you know, and many of the parents of students are parents who have become parents of students in the last 15 years since the things have tightened up, as you were saying. So I think they sometimes look at teachers as predators. And I fear this. So that's why I ask you about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Not anymore on the college campuses. I mean, it really is, you know, there are eyes all over the place. And there are federal regulations, the federal laws. You break that, you can get into deep trouble. Yeah.
On the same wavelength, Tess Gerritsen, your books are often violent. And I think people read them at bedtime, too. So I don't know. You might be responsible for a lot of nightmares. But do you think that that an author has any kind of responsibility? I mean, nowadays, we're very enlightened. And when students look at old films and they say, oh, how could those films be so sexist or racist? Do you think that looking back 20 years in the future, people will look back at some of the things that were produced now and think, how could we produce such violence with lots of, I don't know. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. Frankly, I think looking at horror films today, it could only get worse. I think once society has crossed a line into stuff that's really gross, it's like we never go back. It just gets grosser and grosser. And I'm not sure whether we are going to go back to the, you know, the discrete days of violence off the page or off stage. In truth, I don't think my books are particularly violent because most of my stories have the violence take place off stage. And it's the detectives who walk in after the fact and see the results. And because I'm fairly graphic about the medical details, it feels like I'm being really bloody and gory, but I'm just showing people doing their jobs. But I personally shy away from violent films. I mean, it may seem funny, but I don't like violence in films.
I feel the same way too. I teach horror fiction, and I really don't like, you know, gore fests in movies or TV. I avoid them.
Yeah.
It's very disturbing. I mean, I prefer the psychological aspects of what happens after the violence is over, what happens to those people.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about, let me start with Tess Gerritsen and Gary Braver, if you don't mind. How did you first become interested in writing? You started writing romances and then you kind of evolved into thrillers. How did that happen?
Well, all my romances were also mysteries. So it was, I mean, I think of myself actually as a mystery writer who started off in a subgenre. But ever since I was small, I loved Nancy Drew, and mysteries were always my primary focus. I mean, Sherlock Holmes, those were my, that was my mother's milk when I was growing up. So I think that what happened was after having done a lot of romantic suspense, in which there's always a murder, I thought I would use my roots as a medical doctor and try writing a medical thriller, which is really weird that I hadn't done it. It took me my 10th book to finally get around to using medicine. And that was a really big bestseller. And I thought, well, I should be using more medical details because people clearly like it. They like being let through the doors to see the mysteries or the secrets that doctors may have. And that got me down the road of you know, more, I think, more detailed and more specific medical details of murder and death.
Well, I think you're very inspiring as a writer because you publish so frequently and your books are of high quality every time. Do you have a routine? You must get up every day and write for so many hours or what?
Since I've aged, I feel as if I don't have to turn in a certain number of pages every day. I mean, before, when I was under contract constantly, it was always turn in 4 pages a day. Otherwise, you'll never meet your deadline. Well, I have gotten off the deadline treadmill and I write when I want to, what I want to. But the funny thing is, it turns out I'm writing just as fast as I was before. I don't have that deadline pressure and contract pressure on my shoulders.
But you do have an artistic expression pressure that makes you do it.
Yes. I don't think that ever goes away. And there's a lot of workaholism in my family. And if I feel as if the story is not having some sort of forward motion, I feel like I need to be doing it. I mean, I have to get to my desk.
And Gary Braver, you've published fewer books, I think, than Tess Gerritsen, but always.
Most people have. Yes.
I think I've read fewer books than Tess Gerritsen has published. But what about you, Gary Braver? How did you become an author? I know you're a professor, but which came first?
Actually, the professor came first. In college, I was a physics major and I became a physicist, and I knew after working in a physics lab, I didn't want to do this the rest of my life. And I did have a facility for language, and I started teaching at Northeastern University, and my office mate was Robert B. Parker. Oh. And we became, you know, 40 years of very close friendship with brothers neither of us had. And I watched him spin out 3 or 4 Spencer novels while he was still teaching just a few feet away from me. And I said, if he can do it, you know. And so I said, you're no artiste, you're my buddy. How could you write novels? And I saw that he had demythologized the process. That is, he'd write 4 or 5 pages a day. And he often worked with an outline. He said, you know, just think of it as instead of a 350-page book, take 35 10-page chapters. And you can do that, you know, a chapter a week, whatever. And so I think that was it. And I had children. I had 5 textbooks. I wasn't exactly making princely wages teaching college. So between the first and the second, there were like 10 years that passed. And then after the kids were out of school, I started being more prolific, but I'm teaching full time. So prolific is that's overstated, of 1 every 2 years. Because I was teaching, in fact, even teaching Tess Gerritsen's novels, I became very intimate with, I learned how to read when I became a college professor. I looked at the books the way a carpenter looks at a house, how authors get in and out of a scene, how a strip of dialogue captures 2 separate voices so well. And I really studied it. And that kept me constantly, you know, sharp in terms of my own writing.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO. And my guests this week are Tess Gerritsen and Gary Braver, both great novelists who have teamed up to bring us Choose Me, a sexy murder mystery about a reckless affair and dangerous secrets.
Both of you have had experience with your works being translated to film or television. And Tess Gerritsen, you just said you finished a screenplay of something. When Rosalie and Isles became a television series, were you, I don't know how to ask this. I don't think that Angie Harmon is the woman that you described in The Surgeon, because she's, you know, she's beautiful and all this.
I like to write about ordinary people or people who look ordinary because I want to be able to identify with them. And there's no way Angie Harmon will ever be mistaken for an ordinary person.
No.
But that's Hollywood, you know, that they always choose actresses that look fantastic on screen. And that's just the reality of what it's like out there. Probably I should have, you know, if I were to see a good translation of my shows, it would have been on British television where they have normal looking people on their shows.
Yeah. Did you have any, how much of a role did you play in the Rizzoli and Isles television series.
I had none. I had the best of all jobs. I was paid to be a consultant, and they never asked me anything.
So, I'd like to get that. I'd like to get that job myself.
Yeah.
Did you watch the show?
Of course, I watched the show. I mean, I was really curious how they would diverge from my books, and they did in a lot of ways. The number one thing is they put a lot more humor in the stories. I mean, my books are not funny, or maybe not intentionally funny.
Yeah.
And I found that they had a lot of humor. They had characters sort of spin off in different directions. And they made a couple of choices that I mean, my books are dark and I like dark turns, but they just didn't happen to go that way.
Yeah.
But it's the television audience. Yeah.
Right. And they had to do it in 45 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, that is a real, to have a whole mystery and get it down to 45 minutes. That's a real art.
Yeah. What about you, Gary Braver? Have you had a couple of your things have been translated to film?
Actually just optioned. Three of them have been optioned, but nothing actually yet. We didn't smell any popcorn yet. We're still hoping.
Do you think it's because your work is too complex or?
No. Well, actually some of them are, a couple of novels have underwater scenes. Others are all over the map. We came very close with Elixir. It was Ridley Scott who had just gotten, you know, all sorts of acclamation because of the Gladiator, and then he optioned it again, but he ended up making Hannibal. So it's the right, you know, the right people in the right time. It's so chancy, and no one gets rich on the fantasies, you know. So he just hoped that somebody sees it and said, "We'll do this," but nothing yet.
I guess getting optioned is a lot like being a consultant in which they do not consult with you.
Yeah, there's something. Yeah, you get paid for doing nothing and hopefully you still go all the way.
I think a lot of authors go crazy trying to chase the Hollywood dream. I think that we are novelists primarily, and that's really what we're happiest doing. I mean, I've written a couple of scripts. My first one was turned into a TV movie of the week back in 1996. But that experience taught me that you have to have a different mindset to work in Hollywood. You have to be cooperative. You have to make a lot of people happy. And what I love about novel writing is we are in control. This is our story. So, I don't think it makes sense to like pin a lot of hopes on Hollywood picking up your book, because when they do, often it's just a surprise. And that's what happened with Rizzoli and Isles. It was a surprise. Some producer just happened to have read the books and optioned it. So the other thing that I think a lot of people end up doing is they spin their wheels writing scripts. They try to develop their own books, or they try to adapt their own books to screen. And in the time it takes to write that script, you might have been able to write a book or two. So I think it makes, just for pure sanity, it's better to write the books and hopefully sell the rights to those.
Yeah, the screenplay that you've just written, was that an original screenplay or based on a novel that you'd written?
Oh, it was original and it was fun. It was actually a lot of fun, and it got the attention of people at Lifetime who are now talking to us about writing a darker script for them. So I think that sometimes if you have a story that you feel really should be originally told on you know, in visual media, that maybe is a way to just tell the story. But again, it's a lark. It's just something that we did, and we were surprised that we got the call.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about Choose Me, your new book. And again, it's hard to talk about a thriller, isn't it, without giving away things. And I don't want to do that. So why don't tell us again, in a way that my audience would hear, what's the book about?
Well,
truth and beauty. Can you set it up in a way that doesn't give away too much?
Essentially, it is an illicit affair by a man who is not happy with what's going on at home. He's married to a woman who's got a treadmill existence as a physician. She's very dedicated, very compassionate. She goes from dawn to beyond dusk, and she comes home fatigued. And he has two quests in this novel. One, he wants intimacy. And two, he wants to stay married to his wife. He has a student who is attractive. She's brilliant. She's dedicated. And she makes moon eyes at him. And she makes it known that she's available. So sparks start flying. And she ends up dead. And then the whole thing is, as Tess said earlier, he done it.
Right. Yeah. Of course, actually, she starts out dead, but that's okay. Now, let me ask you about that. Why did she start out dead? And I'm not giving anything away because that's like on the first page. So what made you decide to write it that way rather than to say, here's a story in which somebody dies in the end? Why have her die first thing?
You know, that was a choice that was made. I can't remember when we decided that. But what was happening when we wrote the first draft was that it starts off with Taryn, the student, the beautiful student, and Jack, the professor. And the affair just kind of took off and became darker and darker. And then Taryn dies. And then we introduce the female detective who comes in probably halfway through the story. Well, when we wrote that draft, our editor said, you know, we really love this detective and we have to wait until halfway through the book to see her. What about moving her earlier? And so that's how this flash forward and flashback structure came about. Was I wanted my detective, Frankie, who's I love because she's a middle-aged mother of twins. And she's here looking at this dead college student who reminds her of her own daughters. And so that was it. That was a way to bring Frankie in very early into the story. So you start to see back and forth, what happened before and where Frankie is in the investigation. And little by little, these stories eventually entwine until they both catch up with each other. And then you have one timeline at the end.
Will Frankie be back? Will we see her again?
I don't know. I mean, she's a, I keep saying, I'm aging. I love older female characters. And she is a fun female character. I can see doing another story with her.
Yeah. So in terms of the Me Too aspects of this story, are you both coming to that from the same point of view, or do you have conflicting points of view about the responsibility of the characters in this story?
We wanted conflicting points of view. That was the whole point of having a collaboration. I would look at it from the female point of view and he would look at the male point of view. We didn't always agree. I mean, there were times when I thought, oh my God, do men really think that way? I was kind of surprised. But then I would check in with my husband and he'd go, yeah, we think that way. So we're trying to be realistic and yet not turn anybody into the villain because people, you know, humans are fragile. We make sometimes terrible choices and we want to humanize some of those terrible choices.
And you wanted to have you want your readers to have this discussion among themselves about who's responsible and how responsible they should feel.
Yes, and the thing is that we didn't make them characters in the extreme. I did not create Jack as a Lothario who's irresponsibly having relationships with all his students, nor is Taryn crazy. I mean, this is not what is the movie of
Primal Action.
Fatal attraction,
exactly. No, we didn't want that. So, but, you know, they are human enough so that the readers can understand each's motivations. Neither stands in a mirror in the morning and say, I'm a bad person. And, you know, so you come up with sweet-smelling reasons that justify, your needs.
Yeah. No, there are no bad guys in this book, but there are flawed people. And there's no bad guy, and there's nobody's perfect. That's for certain.
Yes. I mean, although it's not a fatal attraction kind of thing, it does bring up an interesting thing about relationships, which is when you meet a person and you are attracted to them, you don't know what else might be there, because they're not in a situation in which they might reveal their extremes until later.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's marriage.
All these little hidden pockets, you know.
Well, so do you think people get married too soon? Should they live together? Should there be a long?
That's an interesting question. It turns out that the longer you know each other, does not mean your marriage is going to be have a better chance of lasting than people who just, you know, are introduced by their families and get married within 6 months. It's an interesting statistic. And I say that because I have a son who took forever to finally propose to this lovely woman. And I kept saying, well, how long are you going to wait? And he goes, you know that it doesn't matter how long you know somebody, that the chances of your marriage being successful have nothing to do with length of knowing somebody, which is kind of puzzling, but that's the statistic.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro here on KSCO, and my guests this week are Tess Gerritsen and Gary Braver, both great novelists who have teamed up to bring us Choose Me, a sexy murder mystery about a reckless affair and dangerous secrets.
Gary Braver, and I want to ask this in a very polite way, as a man, when I look back on my life after the kind of Me Too movement, you know, kind of really took off and made us all examine our lives, and I was thinking about all the relationships of it that I've had with women, and was I good? Did I do anything that I, you know, if I were famous enough to be Me Too'd, would somebody Me Too me? Did you have that same feeling, and was that part of what you were writing about?
Yes, I suppose, you know, we've had Me Too movements as we look, you know, look back. I mean, maybe putting my arm around a student back in 1976, you know, I'd probably be, you know, pilloried in the quadrangle now. But, you know, it was, and it used to, when you were younger, you were very close to the same age as students. So there was sometimes, you know, the California handshake, which is hugging, you know, that kind of thing. So it was, we were closer in age and closer in experiences. And so that, now I look back, I would not do that. Period.
No.
When I was a middle school teacher, I had a student, I've had many students that liked me and wanted to hug me and things like that. And I never stopped them from hugging me. I tried not to hug them back. But, and there was this one little girl on Halloween, and she was dressed as little Bo Peep. And she gave me a hug. And I said, you look nice. And I gave her a little Snickers bar. A few weeks later, the principal called me into her office and said, did you hug this child? I said, well, yeah. Did you give her candy and tell her that she looked nice? Yes, I did. But I didn't do anything inappropriate or wrong. You didn't do anything that you thought was inappropriate or wrong.
Oh. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, that's what's going to, this is the kind of conversation that I think this book will probably stir. Mm-hmm. You know, most books are read by women. And I think the particularly interesting thing about this book is it really applies to male readers as well. I think men are going to find things about this that they can sympathize with. And that is what you're just saying, is that nobody knows what's proper behavior from this decade to 3 decades from now. Things change so quickly. I mean, there are things that I said 30 years ago that I would never say today. Just tweeting something 5 years ago would now be considered inappropriate.
You can lose your job over something you tweeted 5 years ago.
Lose your job, yeah. It's over something you said when you were in high school. So we're all walking on eggshells.
And is that a valid thing? I mean, do you think that's good or not good?
I think it's good that we are waking up, or we're being more woke now, whatever you want to say, because some terrible things have happened. I mean, and there are people who have been damaged and people who have been terribly hurt. But, you know, it's a pendulum. Sometimes you go the opposite way, where people get overly sensitive, or, you know, you may say something as a professor in class that you don't mean it in a harmful way, but it's taken the wrong way. And that's what makes, I think, the modern world very difficult for a lot of people to navigate now, especially older people who maybe are used to saying things that would be inappropriate today.
Yeah, or that students would mistakenly think were inappropriate. I mean, one of the aspects of teaching on Zoom, which a lot of us have been doing in the last year, is that now those Zoom classes are forever in amber, preserved. You know, when you're standing in your classroom, you might say something. You could even deny that you said it, but you can't deny that you said it if you're on Zoom. because they've it exists forever. Do you find yourself as a professor, Gary Braver, at all censoring yourself from when you did more than you did 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
Yes, oftentimes, yes. No longer stressing, particularly even in our own book, trying to avoid the word beautiful because it's so cliche. She's a beautiful woman, you know, and, you know, you stress other things in characters that you're reading about. And you don't talk about, in this book itself, we have Jack called into the Title IX office because he's talking about, this is early in the book, so we're not giving away, but he's talking about Gone Girl and says he understands in that book and in the movie that, you know, things aren't right at home. He can understand him having a professor having an affair with a student. And that leads to, you know, his getting called onto the red carpet. And so it's the fine points of the wording that becomes prescriptive to people who want to come down on you for saying something that is offensive. And that's what we did, I think, delicately and I think successfully in the book, capturing that exactly what Tess was saying earlier.
And I have to say, Gary taught me a couple things, which, I mean, I'm not aware that they were bad words to say, like the word girl. You know, in my age group, we call each other girls. And I think I had my detective character, who's in her late 50s, referring to the victim as a girl. And Gary said, you can't use that word. We don't use that word anymore. But he was like coming down on me. He was like the more feminist person and scolding me for using a term that I guess is, we don't use anymore.
You know, it's almost co-ed,
that's the other thing. I use the word co-ed. He goes, no, we don't use the word co-ed anymore.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, it's interesting that the language has black holes. What do you call someone who is two adults who are dating each other? What do you refer to the female? You say girlfriend. I mean, woman friend sounds almost clinical, you know, a lover or consort or partner. I mean, you know, there is no easy synonym for girlfriend.
Or boyfriend, for that matter. I mean, if people in their 80s are dating, then it's still boyfriend and girlfriend, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Yes. and that, I guess that's really the crux of Choose Me, isn't it? All the difficulties that come from, I mean, aside from any crime that takes place in the book, it's really about navigating this landscape.
Sure. That's it, yes.
And expertly done. Do you guys think you'll collaborate again? Or are you going to do another book together?
Maybe.
It depends on other projects, because right now I'm working on a spy novel, so I don't know when I'd be able to collaborate.
Is that something new for you, a spy novel?
Yeah, it is. It's because I live in this peculiar little town in Maine that seems to have I don't think I'm breaking any laws here, but a lot of retired CIA live in my town. Oh. And so I thought, wouldn't it be fun to do a story about older? What do you do with an old spy who's no longer working? And what are they capable of? And what if they're needed at the age of 65 to go back into the field? I just love this idea of reexamining middle and late age people. And the fact that we are very often overlooked, you know, once you get to be 65, you're no longer of use to society, it seems. But there's a lot of wisdom there.
Well, all of us are there, but do you see that as a, I mean, you know, people are living a lot longer now. That is, I mean, used to be that, I mean, when we think of all of those movie stars that we loved in the 40s, none of them reached 65. They all died before they got to be 65. But people now routinely live to be 100 years old. So you could be writing about this topic for quite a while.
I could. Next thing you know, I'll be writing about 90-year-old spies.
Yeah. I hope you will. I think that would be fantastic. And Gary Braver, do you have another novel in you that's coming?
I've just finished the second one. There are two in the wings right now, and we're waiting for decisions from publishers, and I'm working on another one. I'm halfway through. And, you know, it's as Kat said earlier, it's a passion that drives you. I mean, it's just something you just don't ever lose, hopefully. I cannot imagine taking up, you know, a carpentry or pottery. I mean, this is what I would do until, you know, until the crack of doom. If I go that
I've
far.
Retired from middle school teaching, but I still love to teach my college class. What about you? Are you thinking of retiring or you'll continue?
Yeah, probably in a year or so. I mean, there is such convenience on Zoom. I mean, you roll out of bed, you plug in, and then, you know, instead of driving and fighting in traffic. But I do miss them in person. We may go back in the fall at Northeastern. It's still up in the air. Northeastern is one of the few schools that the numbers are increasing now that demand that students have vaccination before they go back to class. So that's positive. So I might still see students in person again.
Yes, I'm used to looking out at their blank faces staring at me, and now I have to look at their little blank faces.
I know.
On Zoom, their little Brady Bunch faces.
And the sad thing is half of them are in their bedrooms, lying on their beds with their laptops on their stomachs, you know, and disarray behind them. There's absolutely no camaraderie. They don't leave class and have a coffee someplace. And
that's terrible
it's
for them.
Very,
yes.
Very sad. I mean, particularly with middle school kids. I mean, you remember that. Imagine now what they're going through.
Yes, a lot of my colleagues are still doing it. And I mean, I think that's just, it's just been a terrible time for young people. And for us, maybe not so terrible because I don't want to go anywhere anyway. I get to just sit here and talk to you people, which has been a real pleasure. Well, this new book, it's called Choose Me, and the authors, my guests, the brilliant Gary Braver and Tess Gerritsen, equally brilliant. And I want to thank you so much for spending some time with me on From the Bookshelf. It's a real honor to have you.
Thank you, Gary.
Thank you. That was fun.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.